Today's program is brought to you by Michter's Distillery. Visit Michter's.com to find out how their taste is everything, cost be damned attitude is creating some of the finest whiskeys available.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil wants his groove in them rhythm and blues that Sam is gonna get you some.
Welcome back to the Speakeasy. I'm not your host, Damon Bolte. Instead, this is Jack Inslee, the producer here. And my guest today is Damon Bolte. And if you've listened to this show, then I imagine you've come to know him to some degree as a listener of the Speakeasy. But he does much more than host this radio show, although I wish it was all he did. So I want to welcome my guest now, Damon Bolte, to the Speakeasy. Hey, buddy.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show.
How does it feel to be a guest on your own show?
It's a little weird.
I imagine it's a little weird.
To sit in the same chair, though. That's a little comforting.
Yeah, no, we wanted to take this rare opportunity to teach the listeners a little bit about you, because you can't really interview yourself.
I mean, I'm not Gary Busey, you know, or
right.
Tom Waits.
Yeah, you could try. I don't really know how it would go. But, I mean, there's a lot for us to get into. I want to start by, why don't you tell everybody what you do now? What would your official title be considered now outside of hosting this radio show?
Well, I'm the bar director for Primies and Frankies. I think that's pretty well known. Some great restaurants and bars in Brooklyn and Manhattan. And I also am working currently kind of like hopping around to some different bars, checking stuff out. You know, it's always good to, like, hang out and learn from everyone. I think that's a huge part of this industry. So I'm working a little bit at ZZ's Clam Bar with Thomas Wall and Brian Miller and Phil Ward. I'm helping out a little bit at some other places. Jay Zimmerman's new bar he's opening, Extra Fancy. All these places, all these people that I love so much, you know, it's great to actually be able to work with them. And I'm kind of on, like, part-time level or guest level, you know, it's just nice, you know.
And I mean, you've taught classes on bourbon and cheese.
Yeah, I do.
I do
consulting for brands. I'm working with Brooklyn Gin a little bit, and also Green Hook Ginsmiths just came out with an Old Tom Gin with our buddy Maxwell Britton from Maison Premier. It's a barrel aged Old Tom Gin that just came out last Monday. Pretty limited. I'm also, you know, I contribute to Bon Appetit magazine and other publications as well. And, you know, all the while working on my own bar at the moment and working on a book and playing in a country band. Just doing a lot of stuff.
You know what's funny, dude? I'm looking at your bio on Star Chefs. Totally clean shaven.
Oh, yeah. That's weird.
That is a weird photo.
I wonder if I can ask them to change that.
It doesn't even look like you.
I know. Well, you know, I kind of in my stint in New York City, which has been about almost 9 years, I started out with long hair and a beard. And then I kind of went through some cycles of shaving, mustache, short hair, long hair, and now I'm back to long hair and a beard. It's like that old saying where you spend the first half of your life trying to get away from where you're from and the second half trying to get back there. I feel like I'm at the end. I hope I'm not at the end of my life in New York City.
What a segue, because I want to start where you came from. So I'm not sure if anybody knows, but you are from a very small town in Lone Wolf, Oklahoma. Is that right?
Yeah, its population is about 300 or so.
That's the total population.
It's 300, 350. Most of the people live kind of out in the country on their farms, as my twin brother and I did when we lived there. We ended up moving to Oklahoma City shortly after we graduated.
Graduated high school?
Graduated high school and tech school. We both went to graphic design school. My brother is still in graphic design, and I kind of split off from that. I worked in graphic design and print for a while. The thing is, we both graduated very early. We kind of, like, fast-tracked through school just because, like, by the end of it, we were helping teach the class with our professor. And the dean of the school said that if we both got jobs, job offers, that he would graduate us early. And, like, the next week I got a job offer, moved to Oklahoma City, did that for a while, then got tired of it, got out of it to open up a vintage scooter and motorcycle shop, did that for a while, sold that because it was pretty awesome place, and we had a lot of offers, and it was a pretty fun time. But I was also, actually, my business partner at the time was a sales guy for Glacier, which is kind of like the Southerner Empire, you know, the big distributor, liquor distributor in Oklahoma and Texas, and a lot of the country, actually. So I kind of got like an insight to that side of the job, but this is all before I ever worked in the service industry. I guess you could say I worked in the service industry when I was like in high school, when I was working at the state park at a snow cone stand with like putt-putt golf. So I made some snow cones, but that was my first service, like drinks making job. But I mean, before that, I don't know. I always had this kind of curiosity with it. Like I bought my first cocktail book when I was like 12 years old. I'm saying like a lot.
12, huh?
Yeah.
I want to pause for a second, though, because 300 people, like, to me, I don't know, I grew up in a suburb in New York. That sounds crazy. 300 people. What are your parents doing? You said you grew up on a farm?
Yeah, I mean, we grew up in town. Well, in the middle of town, we also had a field where we grew, like, corn and wheat, mostly wheat most of the time. But the farm is just about a mile and a half north of Lone Wolf, Oklahoma.
Are your parents still there?
Yeah. Alive and kicking ass and... yeah, hanging out. They like to come to New York City because they love the food and the culture. You know, they've got their quiet life there. But then, you know, my brother moved out to San Francisco about 9 months ago, so they get to do this bi-coastal traveling. You know, they really like it. They love the weirdness of both cities and also the greatness of... they're really into food and drinks as well.
Amazing. I mean, so you say you're 12 years old. You're still in Lone Wolf when you get your first cocktail book?
Yeah, so what we would do is every Sunday after church, we would drive to... There are no restaurants in Lone Wolf. There's only one gas station. There's no stoplight at all. The town itself is only a mile long by about a half a mile wide. It's kind of nestled... There's Quartz Mountain State Park, which is just south of Lone Wolf, which is technically part of Lone Wolf. But people usually give it credit to Altus, Oklahoma, which is 26 miles south. So we would drive usually south to either Blair, Oklahoma, or Altus, Oklahoma, where it's kind of the closest city where there's a big Air Force base. And we'd go have lunch after church. There was this place called, I believe it was called Luigi's, totally stereotypical like Italian place in Blair, Oklahoma, which I actually got kicked out of. I'm not allowed back there. That's a totally different show story. We would go to a record store, record and book and video store called Hastings, which is kind of big around, or it used to be big around there back when there were still like record stores, you know, when you could do that kind of thing. And I would always like, you know, go flip through the records, you know, buy my Dead Kennedys albums and then go to the magazines that look at Hot Rod and motorcycle magazines, because my brother and I and my dad always collected it. Kind of restore classic cars. And then I'd make my way over to the book section. And I remember one time my buddy, our best friend Mark, and I, like, we were all hanging out together one time at Hastings. And I was in the cookbook section. I was drawn to it. And I think we were just, like, at a very young age, you know, we were all learning to play guitars together. And this is, like, you know, early 90s. So Guns N' Roses, huge fan still.
Yes.
And every photo you'd see in like guitar magazines or music magazines, they always had a bottle of Jack Daniels with them, you know, or some Budweisers. And I was like, all right, cool. So I guess I was definitely influenced by the rock and roll thing. And so I was like, all right, I guess so to be a rock and roll guy, you got to drink alcohol. So I found myself in the cocktail book section, which was about, you know, three books wide. And there was this book called Sex on the Beach and Other Wild Drinks. And Brian Miller actually has a copy of it. I was flipping through his library one day. I'm like, oh my God, this is the first cocktail book I ever bought. And it's just totally ridiculous. It's like Purple Hooters and, you know, Sex on the Beach. And like, it's just like really bad, like 70s, 80s style drinks.
Yeah, Brighton looking at this book now, it's awesome.
It's and pretty it's, sweet.
They call it the hippest, hottest, most happening bar guide for Generation Xers.
Dude, yeah, exactly. Exactly. That thing, you could probably fetch, you know, a few hundred for that in here in, you know, Bushwick or Williamsburg, because it's super brightly like neon colored and crazy.
Yeah, meanwhile, it's going for one penny on Amazon right now.
Yeah, that sounds about right. It, totally ridiculous book. But I, you know, I picked up a couple of other, you know, sometimes I would see in like magazines, they would have like a cocktail recipe in the back or something. And even just looking at this one book, you know, reading like, what is Curaçao, you know, or, you know, I didn't know what the hell any of this stuff was. Triple sec. That sounds weird.
And you're 12. I imagine you hadn't really been drinking yet or.
No, I hadn't. I had right. busted in my parents' liquor cabinet a little bit, but you know, there were things that I didn't know what they were, but I was intrigued by it. I think just the recipes and the technicality of it, coming from like doing mechanical work on, you know, cars and like working on guitars and like ripping apart my alarm clock and stereo when I was a kid. I think there was, you know, I always liked to work with my hands, you know, eventually working in like print and then doing the scooter shop and then.
So the assembly of the drinks is what.
I think that's what it is. I think it's just like, and my dad, he was a county commissioner of our county, but he got into it with an engineering degree, mechanical engineering degree to his whole thing is he just liked the idea of building. He loves bridges, and he likes the idea of bridges. And I always thought that was pretty poetic, you know, just connecting people. And also, like, you're building something to build relationships, you know, you're connecting people. And I think that's. There's something, I don't want to, put too close of a connection there, but I think, like, building a cocktail is very similar, you know? You have, you know, these ingredients, you have, like, steps of the production, and you're, ultimately, as a bartender, you're connecting people, you're hosting, you're entertaining people. And I think there was always, like, I always knew that in my mind. I always knew that there was, like when my parents would have people over and they would be mixing orange juice and cranberry. And I'm like, oh, that sounds like a great idea. And they're like, can I have a drink of that? No. I'm like, oh, later on I realized there was vodka in there. But I kind of like realized the cocktail party kind of thing, the environment, like where we'd have like catfish fries and people would dance and I'd drink a beer, you know, it was entertainment for everyone.
So what was the first, what are some of the earliest memories you have of imbibing?
Man, I should probably not tell this. My mom's probably listening to this. I remember like having sips of my dad's beer, you know, occasionally when I was very, very young. But also I remember, you know, going to high school parties and, I remember the first times I'd made a proper, well, as close to a cocktail as possible. I remember making margaritas at a friend's house further out in the country from me and my brother's place, but I would make margaritas and they would have limes there for garnish, but I would cut them up and juice them, you know, like they had roses, lime juice, or, you know, whatever canned, like Dole, like the frozen concentrate stuff that you mix with water, you know, they would have, which that stuff's awesome. You just empty the can into a pitcher and then you fill the can three times, stir it up and you got your mix. But I remember juicing limes into margaritas and they were like, Damon, you make the best margaritas. And here I am, probably like 15. And actually, I think that's what stopped getting me beat up. It's making a good margarita. But, you know, this is, you know, 20 years before now. And, you know, using those steps to make something that tastes better. And just the same way as, like, you know, on our farm, you know, like always cooking and doing stuff the right way, you know.
You told me a story about, I don't know if you care to repeat it, about your Angostura bitters.
Oh, yeah. So I was probably about, my mom hates this story, by the way, but it does involve my first, like, kind of like real culinary experience, which is different from most. But there's this small chain of grocery stores in Oklahoma, some in Texas, called United Supermarkets. And real awesome blue and white tile floors, and they, you know, everyone has to wear these smocks that are blue. But I worked in when I was in high school, I worked in the frozen food and dairy department, so I got to wear this like blazer, this blue blazer, kind of like a chef coat slash blazer thing, and I just felt like a badass. I felt like I was like in charge, you know. And I learned a lot of responsibility. Like my the only other people who wore blazers in the place were the green blazers, and those were the guys in produce. So we had the same kind of responsibilities where we had to learn, you know, like rotating through stock and, you know, checking the dates on everything, you know. Anyway, so about 5 years before this, 6 years maybe, it must have been 11 or so, we were, this is our grocery store. And my mom actually worked there. My brother and I both worked there through high school, and my mom worked there when she was in high school. So it's kind of like a strange, like, cool thing. And, yeah, I was, they didn't sell alcohol at all. No beer, wine, or anything. Yeah, we went there one day, and I was, like, looking around the beverage aisle, and, like, looking all over the place. I'm like, whoa, there's no beer, wine, or spirits here. This is crazy. Where do you get this stuff? So, and then I, you know, I'm looking around, like, the Mr. and Mrs. T's, Mr. Boston, like, mixers and stuff like that. And I look at the back labels, and I'm like, huh, no alcohol. That's weird. And then I see this little bottle with an ill-fitting white label and a yellow cap on it at Angostura Bitters. And I'm like, I look at it and say, oh, here we go, jackpot, 44.7% alcohol. It's not scheduled as an alcohol product. It's scheduled as a food product because people use it in baking, all kinds of stuff. So I was really nervous about it because I'm like, wait a minute, I'm like way too young to do any of this, but I'm like, all right, this is a tiny bottle. I'm just going to steal it. So stole a bottle. I put it in my pocket, get back home. I'm like, all right, cool. We're about to party. Go around like the tool shed, take off the cap, and I notice the dasher top on it. And I'm like, what the hell is this? What is this stupid shit? So like any good Okie kid, I've got a pocket knife on me. And so I just kind of like pop the top off. I'm like, all right, here we go. Ah! But I will have to say, and I've given Nick Jarrett a lot of shit about this over the years, that I started the taking a shot of Angostura trend.
All the way back then.
Like 20 plus years ago.
Unbelievable. I want to stop right there. I think it's a good point to segue. We'll get into what happens when you land to New York after the break. You're listening to The Speakeasy with guest Damon Bolte on Heritage Radio Network. We will be right back.
Went to the preacher, said I'm a man of sin. Still didn't need the fear of God, but all he was a man, and I'm going down. Yeah, I'm going down. Yeah, I did it then. Lord knows I'd do it again. I'm going down. So I went to my sister.
We're thrilled to announce a special event, the Silver Snail, 25 years of Slow Food. This event is hosted by Slow Food USA, Heritage Radio Network, and Roberta's Pizza. It's been 25 years since Carlo Petrini and a group of activists launched a peaceful revolution to defend regional traditions, good food, gastronomic pleasure, and the slow pace of life. The Slow Food movement has since evolved into a comprehensive approach to food that recognizes strong connections between plate, planet, people, politics, and culture. Today, this movement involves thousands of projects and millions of people in more than 160 countries worldwide. Join us for a dialogue between Slow Food's founder, Carlo Petrini, and locavore activist, Alice Waters, as they reflect on the evolution of the food movement and all things slow. Friday, October 3rd from 11:30 to 2:30. You can go to our website and click on the link on the right-hand side of the page to RSVP. We can't wait to see you there.
Michter's Distillery is a proud sponsor of In the Drink and HeritageRadioNetwork.org. At Michter's, our passion is making the finest whiskeys possible. When you only make small batch and single barrel whiskeys like Michter's does, your whiskey has to be perfect. No detail is too small, from careful attention to the wood used in the construction of our barrels to lower barrel entry proof before heat-cycled aging in advance of exacting chill filtration. And no whiskey gets bottled until Michter's master distiller says it's just right. Michter's cost be damned, taste is everything attitude is apparent in every sip of its smooth, rich whiskeys. Is it worth it? A lot of spirits lovers seem to think so. Food & Wine magazine called Michter's the best American whiskey. Bon Appetit said, it's amazing. And the Wall Street Journal had one special word for Michter's, phenomenal. For more information, visit Michter's.com or simply visit your favorite bartender or retailer and ask for Michter's.
Welcome back to the Speakeasy. I am your guest host, Jack Inslee, joined here with Damon Bolte, host of the Speakeasy, guest today. We're talking about his life story, cramming it in 30 minutes, if that's even possible. We've got a whole bunch of awesome insight and anecdotes from Lone Wolf, Oklahoma, from Generation X cocktail books to taking shots of Angostura. Yeah. And so just trying to retrace the steps, you end up doing design work and selling motorcycles in Oklahoma City, and then somehow you land in New York. So how do you get to New York?
Oh, yeah. Well, the thing is, like, after my partner and I sold the shop, we, like, as soon as we opened the shop, people were trying to buy it off of us, like the local Harley dealership, the local BMW motorcycle dealership. We ended up, after a year and a half, 2 years, ended up selling to an individual rather than selling to a larger corporation. He was just really into it. Also, my business partner was having like his third kid, and he's married, and he's working full time as a sales rep. I was kind of burnt out, to be honest with you, because I was at the shop every day. After that, like around that time, my band back then, my old band in Oklahoma City, was kind of blowing up, and we were touring a lot. I was working at a guitar shop, and my buddy Brian had this bar called the Electro Lounge, which isn't there anymore. Not because of any like kind of fail or anything like that, but he changed concepts and then he expanded, and he has a really successful like chain of restaurants now, like independent restaurants. But I would go over to his bar, which was like right across the street from the guitar shop I worked at, and you know, I would always talk with this guy about like cocktails, and he was like the only dude in Oklahoma City at the time that like knew how to make cocktails. And I was, you know, a home enthusiast. I'd make cocktails at home. Like after my band would play shows, we'd go to our, like me and my brother's house, and I would make drinks. We would talk about like whiskeys and stuff like that. So that's kind of how I got into making drinks. And we would chat about this. He would, you know, I knew a lot of this from reading cocktail books, but I never worked in it. So you don't really know until you get your hands on it. So I'm sitting there in his bar one day, and I'm like, dude, I'm like 24 years old at this point. And I had worked in graphic design and print. I owned a motorcycle shop. Worked in guitar shops and toured with my band. I'm like, dude, I've done everything in my life that I want to do, and I'm not even 25 yet. This is crazy. What am I going to do? And as I was sipping a Manhattan cocktail, the answer was right under my nose, literally. Like, okay, the city and the idea were both under my nose, you know? So I'm like, all right, I'm going to move to New York City and start cocktailing. Well, I had never bartended before. I asked him to get me a bartending job, and he said, you're crazy. He's like, but you're my friend. All right, tell you what, go work somewhere else for 6 months in a restaurant or a bar, and We'll talk 6 months later. So I go get a job as a waiter at this place where a bunch of my buddies worked. I'm on the floor. It freaked me out the first day because the manager, who was a friend of mine, it was a lunch shift, and it was kind of like a fancy like kind of steakhouse barbecue place. And he just said, just think about how many cows had to die today to feed all these guys. Because it was close to the Capitol. So all the Capitol guys would come over in their suits, and they're like big oaky guys. And I was like, dude, don't say that to me. That's terrible. Don't scare me away from this. I was on the floor for like 2 weeks nagging the bartenders because they didn't know what was in any of the cocktails. Like when people would ask for a Manhattan, they'd shake it and they'd put cherry juice in it. You know, all the terrible stuff that people do when they don't know. You know, they're just like kind of like calling it, you know, phoning it in. So I was kind of nagging them. They were complaining about me. 2 weeks later, the owners were like, let's give this guy a bartending job because clearly he knows more than the other bartenders. And then, yeah, so I was a bartender pretty quickly into it. And my buddy Brian was like, what the hell just happened? How are you bartending already? I'm like, I don't know, man. I learned from the best guy. And he's like, all right, dude. And like 3 months into it, like the time got cut in half. So he was like, all right, I'll give you a job. So then I started working at his bar. And I was actually only bartending about a little over a year before I moved to New York City. My brother and I both decided that we had kind of outgrew the city, even though it's a great city. Now it's completely different. There's cocktail bars and awesome restaurants everywhere. It's actually one of the, as far as like the timeline goes, it's really advanced pretty heavily. But yeah, I moved here and then, you know, worked for.
So you just up and got on a plane and went to New York? I mean, did you have any support systems, any leads on work or living situations?
Well, my brother he was dating a girl here. And so there was a little bit of a support system. We'd all got an apartment together, a big loft in Greenpoint, which I still kind of miss. But yeah, I mean, like we sold our house. We were just like, all right, you know, we could keep this or we can just move, just go for it. We try to sell. We're collectors, me and my brother, like collect cars and guitars and records and motorcycles and scooters and all kinds of stuff, you know. So it was, we thought we'd sold a lot of the stuff off, but we ended up having too much. We moved here with two vans full of stuff. It was like, that's too much for New York City. So eventually kind of like started stripping things down. But, yeah, I mean, we moved here. I got a job at a place that's no longer there anymore. A Japanese dessert bar called Kyoto Fu in Hell's Kitchen. It was cool because I was getting into sake and shochu at the time. So it kind of worked out. I was there for not very long before I ended up moving on to work at Linnell's, the fabled spirit and wine shop that seems like just a fantasy place now, you know. It was you know, not a lot of money to work there, but it was a huge honor to be able to work there with Linnell and learn from her, and not just about like spirits and wine, but about cocktails and also about, you know, hospitality, which she wasn't always the best at, to be fair, but she knew how to run a business and does. And then that's how I met the Franks. One day when Frank Falcinelli came in, he was like, he was wearing a Frankie's shirt, first of all.
Awesome.
And I was like, hey, man, I like that place. You guys have a cocktail with the base spirit is Nardini Amaro. And he was like, yeah, totally. I'm like, do you work there or something? He's like, yeah, I work there. I'm like, all right. He's like, I'm Frank. I'm like, oh, okay, guy. And so we're walking around the shop. I'm helping him out. And he's like, just give me whatever the most baller thing is that you like. Just like hook me up with some stuff. I'm like, all right, cool. Took him over to the whiskey section where we had the first edition Charbet hop flavored whiskey, which basically they distill the Racer Number 5 IPA. And I mean, I was just honest with him. I know the whole Frankie's vibe. So I was like, dude, it's like cash strength whiskey with weed in it. And he's like, sold. Well, we get to the counter and his bill's over $1,000. And he's like, dude, what? How'd that happen? I'm like, well, this bottle's $350. And he's like, whoa, okay. I'm putting that back. I love your style, man, but that's crazy. So I gave him my card. And 2 weeks later, they called me up to consult
wow.
for Frankie's. So I did that. For about 3 months, I had a short contract with them, just revamping Frankie's cocktail program, their bar.
Where were they at this stage in their development?
This is over 6 years ago. And we just celebrated our 10-year anniversary. If I can even say we. I think I can. It was right before Prime Meats. So, actually, we were having like a little lunch, and I had finished my consulting job for them. I had other consulting jobs lined up. And
you're consulting them on the beverage program, mm-hmm. A to Z, or just the spirits?
Yeah, I mean, they had their... Yeah, just the spirits and cocktails, because they had a strong wine program. But they were kind of like working on their... They realized that they had their shit down as far as the kitchen, the food goes, and the vibe and everything. But they needed a little finessing on the bar. So that's where I came in, did that. And then I thought I was done, and then they told me about Prime Meats. They showed me the empty room, and I got to, I was like, all right, they told me about the concept. And I was like, well, man, if I had the money to do it myself right now, this is what I'd be doing. So, yeah, I came on, I thought as a consultant for Prime Meats, but then they ended up not letting me go, which is one of the greatest things that ever happened to me. It's been an awesome ride. And, yeah, love those guys. I love that place. It's gone through some different phases over the past, you know, 5+ years. Or just about 5 years. But all good stuff. And I've gotten to work with, actually every notable bartender in New York City. I mean, I've worked with Jim Kearns, Nate Dumas, Thomas Waugh, Cabell Tomlinson, Katie Stipe, Natasha David. The list goes on and on. Frank Cisneros, Frankie Cocktails. Actually, Frankie Cocktails, Frank Cisneros, got the nickname from working at Prime Eats because there are already too many Franks. So the Franks came to me and they're like, dude, you can't hire this guy. And I'm like, why not? And he's like, there's just too many Franks, man. And then Travis, one of the managing partners, was like, let's just give him a nickname, man. Let's call him, Frankie Mustache. Or because he had a curly mustache at the time. Everyone did at that point. just call him Frankie Cocktails. And it fit the neighborhood, too. The whole, Carroll Gardens vibe. South Brooklyn. Yay, Frankie Cocktails! So that's where he got the nickname. And a lot of people gave him shit for it. Because this is, 5 years ago when, cocktail bartending was, really hitting the mainstream. And everyone's trying to be, the arm gartered, curly mustache guy. And they're like, fuck you for taking, giving yourself this moniker. And he's like, dude. He had to explain it hundreds of times. It's only because there are too many Franks in the building. But
he kept it.
Well, he doesn't call himself Frankie Cocktails, but people still do. Who know him from that time? I've been really blessed to work with so many amazing people. And I've got Garrett Richard and Kate Warnicki and Gino Pellerin and Jeff Galley. You've got all these awesome, newer people in my life. And it's just great. It's the staff that's at Primates has always been badass. I've got Robbie Nelson, Tristan Willie, they both, hang out and work there. It's they're just amazing people. Really, I feel like the quality of the bar staff there has always been just top notch. And through that place also, I've gotten the opportunities, not just through that place, but through Linnell's. I've had the opportunity to work with so many awesome brands and do a lot of event work and just go on some awesome trips. And
it's exploded basically since that happened.
Yeah, since I think the Linnell's thing really kind of pushed me in a direction.
Obviously. Is that when you started really reading up on stuff? Because I mean, you know a lot, and it seems like even when you met Frank, you knew your shit. So I mean, had you been researching heavy?
I had been researching heavily before I worked at Linnell's, and I think that's most of the reason why I got the job. I mean, I think before, when she called me for an interview, she was like, you want to get a coffee or something? And I was like, sure. Or we could just, meet for a beer. And she was like, all right, sold. But, I bought my first book when I was 12. I just love the production of cocktails. But, that's not really it either. I like the social aspects of it. I always say as a bartender, you've got so many elements, you've got political, social, scientific, you've got all these religious. I mean, I almost went into seminary when I was in high school. I'm glad I went to graphic design. That's a whole other show too. I just like being a bartender and the first time I was ever asked if I was a bartender or a mixologist, I said, I'm a bartender, I don't sit in a room in a lab, coming up with weird things. I do it in a bar. That's my lab. That's my room, I'm inviting people in. I want to be a host. I've always wanted to host people and make drinks for them. Not just make drinks for them, just set an environment. I play in a band. It's the same thing. It's you're creating a vibe in a room, in a place, at a time, and you're creating an experience for someone. Or hopefully a lot of people. And that's really what it's all about, being a bartender. And I've just been lucky enough to be able to do it in so many different ways, working with spirits brands, going on these trips, doing press stuff, the show, I've been in a show for almost 4 years now. And part of that was because, and the reason why I got the show is because Patrick Martin, the founder of this, of Heritage Foods and Heritage Radio Network, which I've got to give a huge thank you to, he was coming to my bar all the time. And we would talk about music and we would talk about cocktails. And, you know, he thought that that was interesting. And, you know, because a lot of my menus and cocktails, I'll name after albums or bands or songs, you know, or a lyric, or that's where I get most of my influence from. And so he invited me on the show one day. He kept trying to get me on the show, on his show, on the main course. And it didn't work out, And finally it did. And it just happened to be on December 5th, which is repeal day. So, you know, of course, I didn't know what I was going to talk about before, but then the fact that it was, you know, repeal day, I had plenty to talk about. And it was really great. And then, you know, the next week he asked me if I wanted my own show. So that's how it all happened, you know. And
I remember well.
Yeah.
Just to fact check you here, absolutely right. December 5th, 2010, Damon is on the main course with Daniel Holzman of the Meatball Shop.
The Meatball Shop, yeah.
Which is a funny to compare because, I mean, a lot's happened for him over the past 4 years, mm-hmm. 5 years almost now. Incredible, though. And I remember meeting you, and you had a really big beard at that point.
Yeah.
I mean, that was like the big, big, big beard. You were a pretty intimidating dude at the time. And here you are 4 years later, and your show has become an institution.
Thanks, man. I just love how many people are actually listening to it. It's 4 years ago, I never would have believed that this many people would be into it. And sometimes I'll walk into a bar in like another city, and I'll order a drink, and someone will recognize my voice. And like, oh, shit, are you Damon? Do you host a radio show? I'm like, yeah, man, the Speakeasy. And like, dude, we've been listening to your show for years. And like, you know, sometimes, you know, we've had the Norwegians on, you know, like a few years back. And Brian Miller was very, very awesome to come and like give moral support for them because they were very nervous about being on the air. But it's awesome because they'll, you know, they've told me they listen to the show when they're like shutting down the bar, you know, because of the time difference. And it's just really cool, man. I feel really blessed to be able to have this medium and have so many amazing guests on. I feel like, you know, like really memorable moments, like having, you know, the Bushwick Country Club guys on telling ghost stories, you know, having Dale and Jill DeGroff on and playing, like getting to play songs on guitars with Dale and Jill DeGroff. That's insane. You know, like this is stuff that doesn't happen at your cocktail events, you know, or, you know, in a magazine article. Nothing wrong with magazine articles, obviously, but you know, it's just like there's to have this medium and have people just to have so many people that are enthusiastic about what we do in the food and beverage industry, not just the beverage industry, it just to see the excitement and the the progress over the years. It's really amazing, and I feel absolutely just I couldn't feel any more excited and flattered to even be part of it, you know.
The feeling's mutual, buddy. Thanks for letting me host you this week. It was really, really awesome to hear your story, and I hope listeners appreciate that as well and just know you a little bit more after this week.
Awesome, man. Thanks for the idea. That's really cool. Let's do it in another 4 years.
Yeah, we'll see what happens 4 years from now. Well, that's it for The Speakeasy. You can tune into The Speakeasy every Wednesday, 3 p.m. One of the rare shows that's really kept its time slot here on Heritage Radio.
Yeah.
Wednesdays at 3. That's live on heritageradionetwork.org or podcasted in iTunes. Damon, man, thanks for telling your story.
Thanks a lot, Jack, and thank you, Heritage Radio Network. You've been so awesome to me and to the community, and can't thank you enough.
Well, we'll see you next week.
All right.
For another awesome episode of The Speakeasy.
All right, cheers.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store. by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.